Hello, everybody, and welcome again to Back to the Future, the podcast that talks to the innovators of today who are making the future happen. And making the future happen with me this week are authors, innovators, entrepreneurs, and near futurists. Note I stress that word, near futurists. Henry Coutinho Mason and Rohit Bhargava. Henry, Rohit, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I did say near futurists for a particular reason, because in your book, Future Normal, How We Live, Work, and Thrive in the Next Decade, you actually say that you wear the title of futurist reluctantly. Why is that?
Well, I think it was actually one of the things that bonded us together, this idea that we both felt like we were focused on the future by looking deeply at the present and writing about the present. And I think for us, near futurist was a way of sort of counting ourselves as focused on today rather than projecting forward what could be the future 20 or 30 or 50 years from now.
Do you think it makes it safer to be a forecast by saying that you're like a near futurist or you're closer to the now than the next? Does that make it easier, or does it just mean that you have to think more carefully about what you're going to say?
Great question. And I think it really depends on what perspective you take. You know, of course, there's value in making big long-term predictions about the future for a certain audience. But for our audiences, we're really focused on identifying emerging opportunities in the quite short term. So for us, it's logical to focus on the, you know, what is happening today, and crucially, the opportunities that that presents for people tomorrow.
Okay, so the book title, fascinating, because you call it Future Normal, and the book looks at, I guess, what things will become our future tomorrow. But a lot of the issues that people have about tomorrow is that it's impossible to predict. How do you go about defining what will become normal? I mean, Rohit, if you want to answer that first.
Well, I think that putting two words that don't usually belong together was part of the juicy way, I think, of describing this, because the future is not typically normal. I mean, there are entire quotes, maybe even cliches, about the future being unevenly distributed. I mean, some people have the future and some people don't, the haves and the have-nots. And what we tried to imagine is, what would the future be like for everyone? So what would be the things that would emerge that would affect all of our lives and not just the people who could afford it or who lived in a certain country? And that's what really drove us when we started thinking about the future and what would be normal. And it was the lens that we used to try and imagine what that future could be.
I guess if you're talking about something that's inclusive rather than exclusive, were the things that you ruled out that just while you were fascinated with them and thought they may be, in some ways you just said, well, not really, because they don't really involve ordinary people or everyday situations that we accept as inevitable and more, not just opportunistic, but more likely to happen because more people will buy into them.
Well, I think there's another way of looking at this as well, which Rohit hints at, which is we also have an agenda with the book as well, in that we're very optimistic. And actually, it's funny reading, you know, some of the reviews and the feedback that we're getting. That, you know, that is, if there's ever a criticism leveled at the book, it's that, you know, we are overly optimistic, but we do so in the full knowledge that we are being overly optimistic. And we speak a lot about, while we're writing the book, about the failure of the imagination, and especially around the future, and how there's a lot of dystopian thinking. You know, you only have to go to the movies to see the vision of the future is not a bright one right now. You know, take artificial intelligence, the big future that everyone's thinking about. There's a lot of conversation around job loss, automation. You know, how is this going to destroy, lack of trust in society, et cetera, et cetera. And so we wanted to ask another question, which is, you know, hinted at in this word normal, which is, what do people want? You know, what would we like? And what would everyone like on a universal basis? And that's really, you know, when you ask about how we identify the things to include in the book, it was also viewed through this lens of, what are people's basic human needs and wants? And what, where do people want to get to in terms of improving themselves or improving the places they live, improving the relationships they have with the people that matter to them?
Just continuing on that kind of line of thinking, I actually wrote in my notes when I was reading the book, techno-optimism. Now, this notion that it wasn't just optimistic, but it was also presenting us with a very progressive and positive view of the future. And I guess to Henry's point there, why do we always want, or why do people prefer more pessimistic and more dystopian and kind of dark views of the future?
Well, I think that to some level, the dystopia is more entertaining. I think that's part of it. And also, I think, I mean, it's sort of the same reason why people watch reality dating shows. I mean, they see these people who are maladjusted and just, you know, insecure, and they think to themselves, well, at least I'm not them. You know, like, at least I'm not there. And I think that part of the reason we watch dystopia is because, and I love dystopian science fiction, by the way, I'm a huge fan of it. But also at the back of my mind, I'm like, well, at least I don't live in that world. Like, it's good. And I think that, you know, to Henry's point, a lot of times what we see with futurists is they present a trend and then they present the possible positive outcome and the possible negative outcome. And what that leaves people with is this perception that basically every trend is 50-50. Like, it could either go good or it could go really bad. And I don't think that's the ratio we want. I think that we should weight it more towards if the positive side wins. And so, you know, that's what we tried to imagine.
I mean, I guess really what you're saying there, that if you are setting out to explore the future, you're also creating stories about the future. And those stories give us, I guess, a bridge or a pathway or a plan, map, to imagine how the thing could work out. And I always think that's the best part of how people approach it, but only to give one story. Because I always feel that, to your point, if you give five or six stories, yes, while you're giving people lots of choices, I'm never sure people want choices. You know, I always feel that when you give them too many choices about the future, they'll either choose the bad one, the selfish one, or the one that's most likely to help them gain more advantage quickly. So maybe it also comes down to how we tell those stories about tomorrow that will help us better understand them.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, is that because I know that both of you tell stories when you're writing. And I know that, in fact, I think one of the quotes, Rohit, I read about you is that you're like the Robin Williams of futurism. But you like to be able to tell a
story. I make
stuff
up on the spot.
Well, no, actually, I was more thinking that you choose an apt word or an image or a story that really gets the point over the line and makes people believe it and buy into it.
Yeah.
Or is that just me being optimistic?
Well, I do think that people respond to entertainment because they want to hear stories. And you've already landed on that, right? I mean, stories are what we use to imagine the future. And what was interesting about telling this story about the future is, and I come from a culture, I mean, I fully recognize that American culture is optimistic. I mean, the Hollywood happy ending is basically from America, right? So to some degree, I think people expect that from Americans. I mean, I would lean into that because I spent a long time here. I mean, I was born in India and lived other places, but I have enough American that Henry makes fun of me for it, which is fair. I deserve it. But you know, the point of telling these stories is like, these are real things that exist, right? It's not us saying, oh, wouldn't it be nice if an entrepreneur did fill in the blank? No, these are real people doing real work, real organizations doing real things. And we wanted to tell their stories in a way that would open people's eyes to say, this thing you wish someone was doing, someone's already doing it.
So you've got the way you need to edit, because one of the things I felt in the book that it really captured quite a lot of stories about tomorrow and being a forecaster of futures. I was aware of quite a lot of them. More of them I wasn't aware of, or actually I wasn't interpreting them the way you were looking at. So I'm just wondering, was there a overarching narrative or line that ran through it that wasn't just about these could be our future normal, but other things that linked them together? Because I know you talk about health quite a lot, thriving, you know, the notion of not just the survival of the human, but how humanity will be better off as a consequence of these shifts. I mean, Henry, is that something that potentially you were thinking about, or is that just me post-rationalizing themes I was beginning to spot in the Borg.
No, but I think that's a great observation, and I'm really delighted that that resonated, you know, with someone like yourself, because of course we are writing this in one sense for quite a mainstream audience. You know, as you said, it's very easy to read, and that was a deliberate decision to try and make this inclusive and to appeal to not just people who work within the futures and foresight and intelligence industries. The chapters that I'm proudest of, and the chapters that I think we, you know, sing in the book are, and this is where I have to pay homage to Rohit, you know, his whole brand, the business that he's built, was the Non-Obvious Trend series. And I think that idea of a non-obvious insight is something that, you know, as futurists, and we've already spoken about ChatGPT and, you know, a little bit about what does AI do, where is the humanity in this industry or in any industry? It's about going beyond, perhaps, you know, the kind of the base level, right? And so we always try to push ourselves to find an insight which hopefully, as you say, there are things in the book that you may have been aware of tangentially, but could we give you a new perspective on them?
I mean, I have to say that was one of the reasons why I enjoyed reading the book. A lot of books on forecasting are simply about predicting, you know, what if, what could happen, what happens if we do X or Y. But what I liked about this version of the future is you looked at, well, what the innovation would be, where's the opportunity, and what would be the endpoint benefit? Knitting those three things together, I think, are hugely important in terms of bringing people on the journey. But also, I guess, because, you know, you probably, like, I spend a lot of time with CEOs, with heads of insight, with C-suites. And really, they're not asking you to talk about the future. They're really coming to you to look for answers. And what I felt about the book is it provided me with a lot of very good answers for very little money. I kind of felt coming away from it, but I was a clever CEO and could actually read in the first place, I'd probably go, thanks, chaps. No need to speak more about you. So I'm just wondering if you felt that having put all of your thoughts into the book that actually has now put you out of a job as a future consultant or future forecaster.
I don't know that you can write a book by protecting your ideas and keeping them secret. I mean, that's not the way to write a book. Like, if you're going to put your best thinking out into the world and create an impact in the world, like, you can't be afraid of holding things back. And frankly, that hasn't really happened. I mean, the book has opened the door to a lot of people contacting us and saying we want to take the next step. And so I have heard that before, like, maybe we should hold back a little bit. But we definitely did not. I mean, we put everything that we could imagine into the book and all the value into the book. And if somebody gets enough value from there and they're like, look, we got this, we're good to go, at least they're doing something positive in the world. Like, I would say, at least we did something with it, right? The worst case scenario is that they never even opened the book.
Yeah, no, I think there was no fear of doing that. I did feel that they would come away certainly with a lot of good questions about the future. And I think the right questions, because a lot of the time we're asking the wrong question. But the other bit I felt it really had kind of won me over him was a lot of the stories connected back to people. And there is a tendency when we look at the future to really boil it down to tech and to innovation and abstract and not really to anchor it either to the innovators, you know, the reason we're having this discussion, but also to people themselves. And again, the point that I felt had come through in the book is that each trend in some way or somehow would benefit people. Was that, again, an intention when you were putting it together, that it should still go back to ultimately making people better or even different as they move forward into tomorrow?
Yeah, on the one hand, you know, we have, you know, different perspectives, but of course, we're also very mindful of the privileged position that we operate in, you know, in terms of being able to take the time and having the networks and the reach to be able to speak to some of these people. And so, you know, as we spoke about earlier, it really is, you know, our attempt to unashamedly celebrate as well the instigators who we think are creating a, you know, fairer, a greener, a healthier, more inclusive future. And we spoke earlier about the optimism in the book. You know, one of the other chapters that we look at, we profile this Finnish startup called Solar Foods, which is taking an old NASA technology and they can synthesize this protein powder from waste CO2 using renewable energy. And, you know, we speak to the fact that, you know, this has echoes of Soylent, right? Soylent Green, that kind of dystopian, you know. And so, you know, part of the positioning in the book, as we keep on reiterating, is, you know, there are technologies that definitely have a dark side, whether it's, you know, AI and deep fakes and synthetic media and all things we address in the book. But we say at the same time, you know, in this kind of, you know, this enormous world that we live in with so many people jumping on all, you know, all of these technologies, yeah, it's easy to focus on the negatives and the bad use cases. But as we said again and again, the newspapers just don't feature the people that are out there in labs, you know, and whatever it is, you know, coding away, that are using these technology for good. And so, yeah, it's 100% our agenda with the book.
Is there a strict methodology? I'm going to ask maybe Henry this first. Is there a strict methodology for how you forecast the future? Because in the book, you say, and I'm going to sort of quote you here, you know, you talk about the future being a series of bets, so of looking at innovations in the now that provide us with clues as to what tomorrow could look like. And if I see where other people are placing these wagers, I begin to see how potentially these things could play out. So it's a bit like you're running a horse race and you're seeing which horses look like they're better bets. You're throwing the money on them and then you go, wow, they're about to win and this is a good way of forecasting the future. Or is that just a metaphor you're using to describe a more sophisticated and systematic way of looking at tomorrow?
Well, so there's a couple of points to kind of zoom in on there. So number one, I think, you know, this idea, the reason why we're so passionate about using innovations and, you know, instigators, as we term in the book, that could be individuals or it could be new startups or it could be new products from existing companies, as lenses on the future, is because, you know, we think it works in the sense that once customer experiences are set, if you like, or raised by the market leader in whatever dimension that is, right, around transparency or convenience or choice or design or whatever that is. Once customer expectations are set by that market leader, everyone else has to respond, no matter what category you're in. And I think that's, you know, all of your corporate listeners will be very aware of that. You know, if you're a bank, your peers are not other banks. They are Amazon, they are Apple, you know, they are Airbnb, right, in terms of the customer experience. So that's part of it. The only kind of issue I would take when you talk about the bets there and this idea of, you know, placing a wager on is actually, and this is really important, you know, we're not necessarily saying this particular, you know, instigator that we feature is going to win. And of course, it's nice for us if they do. And there's always that scary moment between, you know, clicking save and going to print, where we were hoping, and we joked about this, you know, please God, let's say they're not a kind of a Theranos style scandal or, you know, a big bankruptcy in any of the startups that we profile. Because there's always that risk. But there's also, you know, there's a deeper point, which says, you know, it's not about necessarily about the success or failure of that specific startup. You know, what we're talking about is can the reader use that startup, you know, to think about, okay, they are doing something in their space, which is not my space, potentially. It's not my demographic. It's not my market. It's not my sector. But actually what they're doing, you know, in response to their customer needs is actually very applicable. It really invites people to have a point of view. And it's actually in the conversation that is sparked by those stories that where the magic happens, not necessarily the stories themselves. It's in the audience's response to the stimulus that we're introducing, rather than saying, this is the future and, you know, this is, you must follow it blindly. It's saying, this could be part of your future. What do you think?
I mean, Robert, is that how you're seeing it when you're looking at the future? I mean, I'm liking the idea, for example, of what are the innovations? So I'm observing what's happening and then going, are these happening in other sectors? That would be more interesting as well, because it shows that there's a certain cascade that's taking place across different cultures. And then are there other people betting on them? I think that was my point about it, because I always think if other people are betting on them, then other people have a vested interest in ensuring that we're going to give these things the best chance to succeed. And I guess the other one is not just about picking winners, to use my horse racing analogy, but being able to have enough knowledge, insight, and accrued skill to know what it is you should be looking out for or where to look, which I guess is what, to your point earlier, you do while you're traveling and collecting these stories. Or again, is your method slightly different because of your kind of cultural background and your industry specialisms?
I come from the world of marketing and advertising, which is an unusual place, I think, to approach futurism from, because first of all, it's just not an industry that's known for that. But to be successful in marketing and advertising, you have to be focused on human behavior, consumer behavior. And that's key. And so what I ended up doing was bringing that same mindset to the work that we would do. And you asked about framework. And actually, I have to tell you, I was very excited to speak with you. And I told Henry this because your work has been a great source of inspiration for me over the years. And we didn't know each other before now. And so...
No, thank you. I get obsessed with frameworks because I think, like you, when I set out in forecasting, people kept telling me there wasn't a framework. Nobody had created one. And that has been the failure of the industry. And actually, the frameworks which I put together in the book were from conversation I had with fellow forecasters and strategists and people in marketing and people in innovation who all had, I think, a very clear understanding of what they did, but hadn't bothered translating it for other people. Because why? Well, you're actually too busy and getting on and doing stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree with you. Like, people do want a framework. They crave a framework. And so with the Non-Obvious series, which before Henry and I collaborated for 10 years, every year I would release a new version of this book, the Non-Obvious Trend Report. And I did that from 2011 until 2020. And in that book, I had a framework, which I called the Haystack Method. And it was sort of about gathering and curating. And my running joke when it comes to frameworks coming from the world of marketing and advertising is every marketing agency has a framework, and all the frameworks have 5 steps. And the first step is some sort of discovery. And the second step is some sort of insight development. And the third step is like, yeah, I mean, they're all the same, right? They just use different words for them. But the reason why they all have a framework is because the expectation is from people that there's a framework and that they'll be able to use it and replicate it. And so now I have, and Henry and I have done this, like we teach people this way of thinking. And early on, I had decided for myself, and I think, and I don't want to speak for Henry, but I think he agrees that thinking about the future shouldn't be something that only a set group of people with some sort of training are allowed to do. It should be something that all of us are able to do and that all of us learn how to do. Now, some people can make a profession out of it, of course, and become professional futurists or forecasters or however they want to title themselves. And people, some people are better at it than others, of course. But this skill set and mindset of thinking about the future by looking at the present and forecasting where things are going to go in a particular industry or even for people's careers, it shouldn't be something that only a few people do. People should feel empowered to do it. And that was the mindset that we wanted to try and bring, I think, to the work that we do.
I guess also the notion that giving people a framework probably more readily equips them to understanding what it is they need to do to go through that process, you know, to get to tomorrow. There are certain steps we have to follow. And I the other thing I felt about your book, which wasn't really, I guess, intentional in it, but it felt like a really good self-help book. And the reason I kind of was curious about that is that I got to a point where you talk about, I think it's augmented creativity, which is one of the sections you cover. And that really reminded me is why I now need to be more proactive, because it did occur to me that using, you know, ChatGPT, I could probably just put in a question about what's the future going to look like, and it would do all of the work for me. Where I felt that your book was giving me the answers to my point earlier, but it was still making me, or asking me rather, to participate in doing that work. And I'm just wondering, now with all of this tech kind of AI around us, will we stop doing that and leave it to the machines to come up with what tomorrow is going to look like?
Well, you know, I don't think so, in the sense that, and I don't think this is saying this just from a position of, you know, arrogance as kind of we're futurists, we're, you know, we're untouchable, because I absolutely believe that, you know, that it will be a huge reshaper of our industry, right? And everyone's perspective, you know, since ChatGPT-4 as well has come out, you know, obviously it's got radically better since we've written the book. I think it pushes us to think more creatively and expansively, you know. And so actually now when I'm, you know, researching a new trend, I will put in, you know, to ChatGPT, this is what I'm looking at, and it will, you know, spit back 4 or 5 key dynamics within this space. And so that's, if you like, that's what I know I have to beat. You know, I have to think beyond that, right? So it's almost like having a competitor right next to you. And you have to say, okay, I have to, so going back to Rohit's point, or Rohit's brand is the non-obvious insights brand. And I think it's a brilliant positioning. You know, there will always be opportunities to do things that, you know, are out of the ordinary, right? And you just look at the consumer space over the past few years and you see brands like Ugly, you know, water, right? The brands that celebrate their, if you like, their imperfections. The infamous example of that would be that Starface brand, you know, that took over Instagram by saying, you know, you've got these patches to hide your acne, and you know, the entire cosmetics industry is about hiding your acne. And someone sits there and goes, well, hang on a second, what if we, the old cliche, what if we zigged when everyone else is zagging, and we celebrated them, and we turned them into something to flaunt?
Are there any other things that you think with AI, the advances we're seeing, you know, things like Stable Diffusion, that in terms of how it can visualize the future, are there any other things you think we could be doing with it to make our futures better and more about people rather than about technology and synthetics and the stuff that we normally assign to the future? Rohit, maybe I'm going to give you that answer, question rather.
Yes, is the short answer. I mean, I could give you so many examples. I'll give you a couple. One is, imagine if we had AI take every piece of confusing legislation that politicians have come up with and make it one page or less. That would be one usage. That would be great. Same thing with contracts, right? Have AI rewrite these contracts to be in plain English instead of legalese.
I see a lot of litigation coming through from our lawyers listening.
I mean, I honestly think when people ask me personally, what industry is going to be most disrupted by AI, they think that we're going to say creative industries or writing or art. But I actually think it's going to be law.
Yeah, law, marketing, accountancy. As somebody said, the annoying professions, the one that we all hate and all feel that if there's any god out there, an exacting revenge would be AI.
Yeah, look, I personally don't hate lawyers. I think that law keeps order in many cases. I think the problem is that it's become so confusing that only the lawyers are benefiting from this deeply confusing legalese. And the rest of the world would love for contracts to be a page. And by the way, as a writer, I can say this, it takes longer to do it shorter, to make it shorter. It's easier to write a 26-page agreement because you don't have to take anything out and you don't have to edit it. And nobody is going to read it.
I mean, it's actually fascinating. As you were saying, I was thinking, God, of all of the things I've thought about when I use various chat or open AI systems, I never ask it to make things simple. I mean, in itself, that's quite an insight. Because we're always trying to, you know, to elaborate, to ordain. We're always trying to go from, you know, the Cistercian to the Baroque.
Honestly, I can't even take complete credit for that because it's my son who's 15 years old who's using ChatGPT to ask it to explain concepts he's learning in school to him as if he's a 5-year-old. That's his prompt. Wow. Explain blank to me as if I'm a 5-year-old. And he gets a description of it that helps him understand.
So already you're coming up with one of those solution, which is really about what is it we want these things to do versus the fear of what they will do. That's the question perhaps we should be asking. Just I'm just aware of time, and I'm going to ask you both maybe to consider of all of the areas and of all of the forecasts and near future things you looked at in the book, and perhaps Henry, you can answer this one first. What are the ones that you're gambling on most, or the ones that you would really like to see happen quickest? If this is your list of future bucket list, you want it now. What are those things roughly? They don't have to be in order. Just give me a sense of how the future is looking according to Henry.
I think for me, the ones which, you know, I'm most passionately hopeful about, if you like, are the ones that, you know, remove some of the guilt from our lives. Because I do think, you know, Rohit, you mentioned your son there. I'm always fascinated by the question, what will our children look at us in horror about? You know, about the things that we do today, that they will say, how did you just do this without, you know, like people smoking indoors or on planes, right? We kind of look back and thinking, you know, how did anyone think this was a good idea? So I think that the chapter on waste-free products and, you know, this potential for, you know, everything to become kind of natural, circular, biodegradable is super interesting. And, you know, related to that, the production of food and the production of, you know, just the products that we use, if we could exist in a world where we don't have to make huge compromises, because I think we've seen that, you know, we don't like changing our behavior, right, in many instances. But if we could live, fly, eat, you know, whatever it is, in similar ways to we do today, but without any of the guilt, the environmental and ethical guilt, I think that would be a huge step forward.
Perfect. Rohit, are you in agreement, or do you have a simpler solution from your ChatGPT? You coming up with a shorter answer?
Let's press pause. Let me go and ask, and then I'll... No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, I do agree with Henry. The other space, though, that I am very excited about is energy and how we get energy. I mean, I think that to Henry's point about our kids looking back and thinking, you're crazy. Like, why would you even do that? I think that in the future generations will look at us and say, the sun was giving us unlimited power and we knew how to create solar power. And all we had to do was invest more time and effort to make these panels cheaper and more ubiquitous. And we didn't focus on that. That'll seem crazy.
You know, that I think was the fascination of the book, is that you aren't just asking the questions, you are providing the solutions. So I'm kind of going to recommend it as one of my top reads, not much of the top reads, actually, one of my top boys for this week, The Future Normal. It's how we will live, work, and thrive in the next decade. And just to be clear, it's not just about technology. What I did like about the book, it covers the emotions, the insights, the opportunities about work, health, well-being, you know, whole issues about our emotional selves, our identity. So both digital, emotional, that kind of multiplex thing, cities. I mean, all of those areas are perhaps, well, if I'm kind of investing in the future, we're really going to have to be asking questions about them. It's published by Idea Press Publishing, Rohit, which I think is actually your publishing company.
Yeah, that's right. It's an independent publishing company. We've done nearly 100 books from different authors now. So it's definitely my other brand.
Other ones to do. And is that, I can get it, I know, on Amazon, but can I also go to independent bookshops to buy copies of the book
there? Yeah. Independent bookstores. Internationally, the distribution is a little bit slower because the books have to make it there and the industry is not that fast.
Good. Well, I think actually...
But eventually, it will be available in all bookstores.
We should be able to help you with that by publicizing it in our own small way.
That would be great. Yes, thank you.
Guys, many thanks for speaking to us. There will be an accompanying blog with the podcast, which will contain all of the links to the book, to your respective businesses, but also to just some of the ideas that you'll be thinking about over the coming weeks.
Thank you.
My name is Martin Raymond. As always, I'm going to ask you to keep on looking, keep listening if you can, keep learning, and of course, keep asking what's new and what's next.